Good evening and welcome to Thursday's Late Debate. Joining us tonight, we have Patrick Costello, Green Party TD for Dublin South Central, Jennifer Whitmore, Social Democrats TD for Wicklow, Ruth Coppinger, former Solidarity TD and part-time teacher, Fine Gael Senator Tim Lombard, and Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with Independent News and Media. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551. You can email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Well, things have accelerated beyond even what we anticipated a week or two ago. So said the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, today as he confirmed that there were 1,205 new cases of the disease notified to the Department of Health in the past 24 hours, the highest number of cases recorded in a single day since the start of the pandemic. We were told at this briefing that we are heading for between 1,800 and 2,500 cases a day by the end of the month if we stay on this trajectory.
It's clear that the disease is not in control. We share that challenge with not just our colleagues in the north of Ireland, but in almost every country in Europe. The rate of spread, the rate of increase in the burden of infection in almost every country in Europe is increasing at a rate that almost no country could regard itself as having this virus in control.
And that was Dr. Tony Houlihan speaking a few hours ago. And I'm joined on the line now by HSE Public Health Specialist, Dr. Una Fallon. Dr. Fallon, you're very welcome to Late Debate.
Thank you, Katie.
Just listening to Dr. Houlihan there, this sense that this is now out of control, does it feel as a public health specialist in the field that this is getting away from us?
Certainly, the numbers of cases have been increasing day on day over the last week or more, and it is becoming increasingly difficult for us to contact all the complex settings that we have been doing over the previous weeks to advise them and to determine whether there's an outbreak. So I suppose it's expected in a pandemic that's accelerating that you, have to prioritise what you do. And certainly we're getting to that stage now. The scale really is beyond the capacity to investigate every single case.
And in the cases up to now that you've been tracking, can you tell me about some of those settings that you're investigating and the patterns of transmission that you were seeing? Because I know we were hearing a lot a few weeks ago about communions and confirmation parties and kind of extended family dues in houses.
Yes. I suppose the bulk of what we see during any 1 or 2 weeks can be characterised in different ways. And certainly in early September, we were seeing a lot of cases associated with what we were calling amplification events. So events where you had a chance, where there was a lot of spread of illness and where the numbers could easily increase. And they were things like holidays away, group trips away.
And was there a lot of that going on, Una?
There was really, and I think it was the time of year, you know, it was the end of summer for some, and it was the beginning of, you know, new student terms and semesters for others. So there was a lot of that going on. And then we were seeing some slippage in, was it funerals and wakes, and then there were communions, you know, communion parties, communion dinners. And then I think over the last week or two, we've seen a lot of cases associated with sporting celebrations, and that, you know, has, I suppose, come to the attention of people in the last few days.
This is the club, these are the kind of the celebrations around club championships and that.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And I suppose I tweeted this morning, I was trying to assess what might be next, and I think that the third level student has a lot of variation in their life, a lot of journeys, a lot of movement, and I think that's probably the what we're going to be dealing with over the next few weeks.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people, if anyone's familiar with families who have third level students who perhaps rented accommodation, they're then told that they can study remotely. But a lot of those students have gone and taken up that accommodation, and a lot of those students will be mixing with each other now, and then of course maybe going home to yeah. mammy and daddy.
Well, I suppose the modern student life does involve a lot of movement. You know, they do go home to their parents, perhaps play sporting at home, maybe have a part-time job at home, and then come back to college, go into college, do their practicals, do their online courses in their own house, but often together with other students, which isn't exactly what it was intended for, maybe have work placements, and then there's the potential for socialising. So we know that cases are increasing in that young age group from 19 to 24. We heard that tonight from Philip Nolan. So I think that is a group that we do need to communicate effectively with now and to have some focused messaging with.
And when I look at the figures, the 14-day incident rate figures for today, there's a huge variation between counties really some very startling figures. Obviously, we know that the border counties are being very badly hit. But when you look at the figure for Cavan, 639 cases per 100,000 over the last 14 days, which compares with just 77.9 for Wicklow. Just to give a sense of how kind of out of kilter it is. Any sense of those very high counties, apart from the cross-border element, any other sense of what's happening there?
I think I don't know of any specific outbreaks that could really account for those numbers, and that really does look to me like it's spillover uncontrolled community transmission, and that it is a spillover from an area that has a higher incidence rate. I don't think there's any particular activity, setting, outbreaks that is driving those actual figures. But they are at level four now, so it would be very challenging for people who live in those areas to adhere to that and to try and bring these rates down.
And I suppose the last lockdowns or restricted situations we had were in the area. You're based in the Midlands there, Una, aren't
mm-hmm.
you?
Yes.
And that was seen as very successful, the Laois, Offaly, Kildare lockdown
yes.
that we had. But that was different though, wasn't it? Because we could see exactly what was driving those figures, and we could target those meat plants in particular.
Yes, there were particular outbreaks, and a lot of people worked very hard, including the workers in the factories and the factory owners and the various agencies and us in the public health departments and the HSE in terms of testing. So there was a lot of collaborative work to get those situations under control. And we had learned a lot from the first wave, and there wasn't a lot else going on at the time. So that is why that worked. It was easy to, or it was relatively easy to focus attention on those particular settings. But when you have a lot of transmission, it's very hard to track and intervene or, implement controls to stop it.
And we heard today that Tony Hoolan again talked about yourselves, the public health specialists around the country, who are working really hard to investigate and get on top of this. But he said, everyone is exhausted. How tired are you? How worried are you, Una?
Everybody is really tired. I suppose one of the things that characterises the whole pandemic is that it truly changes. The work changes from week to week, and I suppose we've never really been, while the case numbers dipped, we've never really been out of it. I suppose there's a really good work ethic, and everybody wants to do as much as they can, but there is a point when the numbers become so vast that we have to prioritise, and I suppose people are a bit sorry about that. People would really like to see their work being successful. I think we have had some good successes, and we have kept the lid on various situations, but now we have to concentrate particularly on the vulnerable. We have to protect the vulnerable over the next few weeks and months, I think.
And before I let you go, Una, can I just ask you about the issue of schools? Because, you know, the debate is still raging out there about whether or not keeping the schools open, which is obviously a political priority and a big priority for a lot of parents as well.
Yeah.
Whether or not that might be contributing to some of the community transmission that we're now seeing. I know that we were told at the briefing today that this isn't the case.
Yeah, you heard Philip Nolan say while the rates were increasing in the younger age groups, it was at a very slow rate in comparison to the other age groups. There's been a tremendous amount of work with the schools, the teachers and the principals. We get cases in schools and we work hard to try and determine where might the source be for those cases. And, you know, almost invariably the source is the family or a community setting. And then our job is to determine, has there been transmission within the school? And there has been some, but remarkably little. It's been a steep learning curve for us over a period of 5 weeks. But that is the case, and it is consistent with the international picture. And the principals have, you know, really pushed the boat out to identify contacts. We try and get them tested really quickly, and sometimes they need a bit of breathing space to close for, you know, a day or two. And sometimes the whole class has to be out for 2 weeks. But overall, it has been very successful to keeping the schools safely open. That is our mission, and that's what we certainly will be prioritising that over the coming weeks and months.
But just to go back to the point you raised earlier, while we're not seeing a lot of transmission in that very young cohort, you are concerned about what we might be seeing now in the next week or two from the mixing of third level students.
I think that age group, 19 to 24, is where the incidence is growing at the fastest rate, and it's the age group where we need to give a bit of our attention now.
Okay, Dr. Una Fallon, many, many thanks for joining us with that, and best of luck with your work and to your colleagues as well out there. We are depending on you big time. I want to thank my panel for bearing with me there. Can I just go to Hugh first and ask you the feeling in political circles today about where we are at now with these figures?
I think we're at a stage, Katie, where an awful lot of people that I've spoken to in the last, today really, and yesterday as well, they feel that we are at a stage where we are probably inevitably going to end up in higher levels of restrictions. We're going to end up in level 4, potentially level 5. No one is, I suppose, talking about that publicly. But I mean, I think if you read between the lines of what the Taoiseach and Taoiseach just said last night at the press conference announcing the moving of Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal into level 4 restrictions and the enhanced kind of almost level 3.5 for the rest of the country, you do detect that we are moving into a stage where more and more restrictions are going to come into place, and we're almost kind of waiting for those restrictions to be put in place.
Any sense of why the cabinet moved yesterday ahead of, you know, we knew NPHET were meeting today to get that nationwide?
Well, I think they moved primarily because of what was happening in Northern Ireland and what Arlene Foster had announced in the Assembly in terms of the restrictions in Northern Ireland, which are kind of a hodgepodge of what we have down here in terms of closing bars, pubs and restaurants entirely to and only having them available for takeaway, but for example leaving churches open, leaving gyms open. So the restrictions differ, I think, quite, you know, the restrictions are in some ways kind of quite similar to what we have in level three, but in certain other ways they are kind of quite similar to kind of level four, level five restrictions here in the South or the Republic. And I think that what the government was trying to do yesterday was respond to what was happening in Northern Ireland, but also respond in terms of moving Ireland into kind of, or sorry, the most of the counties in Ireland into these kind of level 3.5, as I would describe them, restrictions, okay. You know, taking account of the rising number of cases. But, I think really the problem for the government is that NPHET warned the government over 10 days ago now that we really need to move the country into level 5 and effective lockdown for 4 weeks. The government decided to reject that advice. Primarily because they were concerned about the economic and mental health impacts of that decision and the belief that the country wasn't ready for that. But I think, you know, the very fact that we've been discussing the idea of level five restrictions over the last few weeks, over the last 10 days, I guess, is kind of almost getting the country ready for that. And I think that's kind of inevitably the space into which we are moving.
Tim Lombard, I'm sure Dr. Tony Holohan would be too polite to say so, to say I told you so, but he did tell you so, didn't he?
I suppose in many ways, first of all, the contribution by the doctor in the early part of the show shows you the actual frustrations, the fears, and I think the actual anxiety that's out there in the communities themselves. I think that's something is a very, very powerful contribution. I think what's after happening the last 10 days.
But what it also showed me, though, is that basically people were doing things that we were, you know, told we shouldn't be doing. That there was a lot of...
Oh, there was, definitely.
And you know, group holidaying,
and we saw
a lot of partying.
We saw, like in my own part of the world, we saw, you know, celebrations after county finals gone mad and stuff like that. And it didn't happen in Cork, it happened all over the country.
So go back to my point, though.
Yes. And I think, Dr. Holohan, when he came back on that occasion, he was trying to move the country from level two into a level five scenario. I don't think we were actually mentally there at that stage. I don't think society was there. I don't think the economy was there.
Do you think the virus cares whether we were mentally there or not?
No, but I do think we actually had to have a phase of working towards and working with all sections of society to make sure we are going to be in that space. And look, we know which way the virus is going. It's not going to go to level one or level two. And we're now working towards, you know, getting society ready for what's going to be a very, very tough 6 months. I think it's very obvious that the figures have shown continuously for the last 3 months they're going one way. I think the government have put plans in place even yesterday with the budget to actually ensure the economy will survive going forward. But more importantly, I think the actual mental health of society just wasn't there at that stage. I think the idea of going to a level two across the entire country in one go would have been a huge step forward. I'll give you an example. You would know Bantry very well. Bantry had no case of COVID-19 in their electoral area previously. And to go from a level two to a level five in that part of the world would have been an exceptionally hard step to take.
But there must be more Bantries around the country still.
Absolutely.
And do you think that they are going to have to go from where we are now, level three?
Yeah, I think, look, as Hugh O'Connell stated, it was probably level three plus is where we are at the moment. I'm not sure where we're going to go in the next few days, but I do know one thing. This virus isn't going to go away and we're going up instead of down.
Ruth, you were tweeting about this today or yesterday when that ban on the household visits. You said personal relations and mental health take a hit, profits keep going.
Well, the reason that I said that is that in the context of an overall generalised lockdown, which we all went through, you know, back in March, April, the idea of not visiting, you know, ageing parents or a dear friend or somebody who really relies on your company was accepted. But I've certainly found, even among health workers, among frontline workers, people who've been extremely, you know, obedient and fastidious, the idea of we can go into a school. I was in a school room today with 23 others for an hour at a time, you know, throughout the day. But yet, you know, you can see your workmates, you can see your employer, you can see strangers, you can go to crowded streets and shopping centres still, but yet you can't visit, you know, somebody who is very near and dear to you. And I think we have to question why we are here. We had a recommendation from NPHET of a general lockdown, level five, which was ignored by the Taoiseach and ignored by this government, I think primarily for the reasons of profit and the economy.
Well, no, I think I don't know if ignored the right term. I mean, it was dismissed
for rejected.
Being not thought true was what we were
and,
told.
And the reason that they recommended it, it wasn't for fun, or it was for it was because our health service cannot cope with the predicted surge. And in the intervening months since the last lockdown, this government has failed to invest adequately in the public health system to bring our ICU and acute beds up to the capacity that's needed. We're still the lowest in Europe. That's why we are going to inevitably have to suffer another lockdown. And Gabriel Scally made a good point on, I think it was Morning Ireland today, about Groundhog Day. And that's what this is. Until there's a serious investment, which involves a questioning about the whole economic policy that we have of low and no taxation on wealth and on multinationals and corporations, because what's involved is of such a huge magnitude.
Can I just clarify the actual beds? I think the general public need to know there's been a major move in actually the amount of beds that for the ICU. Like those 255 beds, they're now previously in 2020. 2021, there's 321, which is a significant jump. And it's not just buying a bed. This is about having a full team around you, four nurses and whatever else is required.
You're a TD for Cork, though, and there's no ICU capacity in Cork, according to the Irish Examiner. You can trot out all the figures that you like. We have the lowest ICU beds.
I'm sure you're glad to be promoted to TD.
Exactly, if only the election worked out like that.
Or sorry, you're a representative for
But Cork. Yeah, we were hearing from University Hospital in Cork today, and they are in a very bad position already having to tap into the surge, which of course we know means that other surgeries and other care has to be curtailed.
And the CUH is, like, obviously, you know, it's the level one unit in Ireland, really, really powerful institution in our part of the world. But there is backup there, because you look at the private hospitals, whereas the bonds, whereas the matter private, they're also available in Cork City, which were available the last time we had an emergency. And there's ICU capacity in both of those units as well. So we have backup capacity if required, subsequently to what we did previously.
But we're hearing from the HSE today, we're hearing from Colm Henry and from Paul, they are concerned about capacity with the way those figures are going.
And we're all very concerned. Like 1,205 new cases today is not a good statistic. But at the end of the day, it's about trying to ensure that we can actually get the message out there. And that's why this very hard statement we're saying about trying to, you know, limit people going to their actual houses itself. It's about that community transmission.
Jennifer, I want to bring Jennifer in on this, because I know Roisin Shortall, your co-leader, was out on this today. And I think a lot of people were kind of prepared and hearing the story yesterday about the border counties and the numbers there, and they were thinking, OK, they're going to go to level four. But that announcement last night about the nationwide ban on visiting homes, that really threw a lot of people for six, I think.
It really did. I think since February, we've spoken about, like, people cocooning and staying at home, and home was the safe place. And I think it feels to people that that's no longer the case, and even they can't have, you know, one individual into them. I mean, we have to consider people's mental health in this as well. And I think to say to people that they are going to stay at home, whether, you know, if you're working from home even, you don't see anybody else during the day, you don't see your work colleagues, and now you can't even have one person come in. So I think that is incredibly restrictive. And I think some thought should have been given to the social and mental health side and aspect of that decision, because it is going to be a very, very difficult thing for people to do. And what's going to be more important over the next weeks and months is that we bring people along with us. And if they don't understand what restrictions are being put in place, and if they can't see the rationale for them, we won't be able to get them along.
But Roisin was saying that we should, Roisin Shortall was saying we should revisit this. Revisit it, not to use a pun, but instead of that, they should be allowing bubbles or you know, of maybe one or two people to visit people, particularly people who live on their own.
Yeah.
And I know we were in the UK, they have this social bubble concept that if you are living on your own, that you can nominate a household, basically, that you then become part of, and you can interact with them as if they were in your own household.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thinking you were going to be pushing for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the concept of a bubble is a very simple concept, and I think it's one that people will understand and they can get behind. And it's worked in the UK and it's worked in New Zealand. I think one of our big problems is the messaging is not clear for people. And, you know, we're talking now about a level 3.5. Like, there's a... You know, know, there's conflict in the messaging that's come from within government, and in actual the plans and the restrictions and the levels, and people will not be able to get behind
that. I just want to put that to Patrick. Patrick, apologies for getting to you this late in the show. That messaging issue is increasingly becoming an issue for people, and the rationale, not just the messaging, but the actual rationale about the decision. People understand what they're being asked to do, but they don't understand why they're being asked to do it.
Well, I think the messaging has been quite straightforward. You know, as Dr. Ronan Glynn was tweeting today, you know, we have to make a choice about the amount of contacts we have and the amount of people we see, because every time we meet somebody new, every time we have another social interaction, it's another chance for us either to spread the virus unknowingly or for us to meet someone who has it and to contract it. So I think people understand that the more people you see, the greater the risk is, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why these enhanced restrictions are coming in, you know, to try and do that. And as Una Fallon was saying at the top of your show, you know, we've seen a slippage in and sporting celebrations and people getting together and the virus spreading as a result. So I think people do understand exactly why we need to protect ourselves and protect each other by reducing our social contacts. I do think those support bubbles are a very good way of trying to protect people's mental health and social health while also protecting our physical health. Remember, we're keeping the schools open to protect the mental health of the young people as well.
Would you be pushing for that within your own party?
Yeah, no, I would, because look, my daughter's in a creche that is built around class bubbles, that the kids are in a bubble with just those other kids and with the teachers in the room with them, you know. So it's a system that we're trying to push into our schools. It's a system, as Jennifer says, that has worked very well and ensures that those who are older and vulnerable or alone aren't left isolated. I do think it's definitely a thing that we should be looking at. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the messaging is wrong, because the messaging is still we need to reduce our amount of contacts we have with each other and how we interact so that the virus has less of a chance to spread. And if you're in a bubble, the virus has less of a chance to spread. You know, so I think it's the message is straightforward. We need to just stop giving the virus the opportunity to spread.
I do think, though, that message, and a lot of people have obviously taken on board that message and have worked really, really hard and denied themselves a lot of social activity over the last number of months while seeing others not taking those steps. And I think people who have very few contacts being told to reduce your contacts is actually enraging people at this stage. And the fact that blanket ban was introduced yesterday without any reference at all to all of those people, young people and old people, who are living alone. That there wasn't, given how much we now know about the mental health impacts of that there should there not have been more thinking put behind that?
Well, I think the message has been about individual responsibility and has been clear to saying that, look, some people are doing this right and some people are taking too many risks. And those risks are not just for themselves, but for everyone they ultimately interact with, because every interaction is a new chance for the virus to spread or a new risk of contracting the virus. So I think the messaging has been very clear there. I think there's a challenge that we don't want to start finger pointing and saying, oh, it's all that group, it's all the young people, or it's all the students, it's all their fault. So we do need to be careful in our messaging that we don't start apportioning blame, and we're talking about how we can work together to reduce all this.
Okay, let me just give you a flavour. I did ask people to text us in on 51551. We have Katie, always enjoyed the show. Thank you. I have to ask, where were the Gardaí when 65 people were in a packed pub with 15 GAA players in County Galway last Sunday week? Had they cleared the pub, they could have saved a whole rural village the nightmare we are now in, with over 40 positive cases and over 300 self-isolating since today. And I've got the address there, but I'm not sure of how well that's known, so I don't want to be... I might leave out just the address of that village. COVID-19 and government health policy. As usual, government is putting profit first and the common welfare of society second, says Kieran Tralee. What about these reports of politicians and members of media showing scant regard for social distancing, etc., and being less than polite when requested by COVID compliance officers to obey regulations, says James in Tipperary. I did want to ask you about that story, actually. Did you see that story, Jennifer?
I haven't, no.
There's a story in the Independent today saying that TDs have been given a severe severe rebuke for failing to comply with COVID-19 guidelines and rules, and in some instances abusing compliance staff in Leinster House and the Convention Centre. And actually in the same today as well, there was a story that barristers and solicitors have been given a slap on the wrist for breaking social distancing rules in the four courts. And a Garda in Kerry, the district court had to be cleared in Kerry because he got his positive COVID test while he was sitting in the courtroom. And he had to tell court authorities. And so he'd obviously gone to court having taken a COVID test. Can I ask you about that in the Convention Centre and in Leinster House? Tim, have you noticed people not being particularly careful about social distancing?
Well,
given how much we're paying to get the space so you can socially distance in the Convention Centre.
I don't think I've been to the Convention Centre once because the Shannon doesn't sit there, obviously. So I can't talk about the Convention Centre, but I suppose in the Dáil complex or Leinster House complex, I think it's worked really kind of well in many ways. The majority of people wear masks, I think. I've had no major issues at all, and I think... Look, from my point of view, I've seen no major issues. I read the article, it hasn't turned up in the Shannon. We would have smaller numbers, though. I think that has to be said. We're dealing with 60 rather than the multiple that you have to deal with at all.
Jennifer, you haven't noticed this?
No, I mean, to be honest, both the Convention Centre and Leinster House are really well organised, and people wear their masks all the time. Even when you're in the canteen, the tables are 2 metres apart. It is very, very well controlled.
There was actually a line in that story about people moving furniture in the canteen.
Been an issue, Katie.
Yeah, Hugh.
This was a story that myself and my colleague Philip Ryan reported on earlier today, and it was a very sharp rebuke, according to members of the business committee that we spoke to earlier today, that was issued by an official from the Oireachtas who's in charge of ensuring that members and indeed staff who work in Leinster House comply with the COVID-19 rules and regulations. And one of the issues they did cite was that both in the canteen and in other parts of the Leinster House complex, furniture that is spaced out for a specific reason to ensure that people are socially distanced and 2 metres apart is being moved. And in some instances, COVID-compliant staff in Leinster House are being met with quite a abusive or certainly a resistance from members of the House. Some members of the House, certainly not all the members of the House, to effectively request that they comply with these rules. So I think that this is certainly an issue that's come up. And one of the specific instances that was cited is this picture of Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue ascending the escalator at the Convention Centre on Tuesday before they delivered their budget speeches, where they were not wearing any masks. Now, a spokesperson for Pascal Donoghue told us earlier today that in broad terms, that he had adhered to social distancing requirements, that he'd wore his mask in most situations in Leinster House, and this was a brief period where, obviously, or in the Convention Centre rather, and this was a brief instance where he didn't wear his mask. But certainly, there's a concern amongst officials in the Oireachtas that some members of the House are not adhering to the rules and the regulations and the guidelines that are laid down for every member of the public.
Well, as a former TD, I have to say, people who are working in schools are looking at green with envy at the Convention Centre because of the type of social distancing that is being afforded to TDs. And it isn't that anybody begrudges it, but I feel I have to say one thing on behalf of teachers and school staff and SNAs. I think people feel they're not being listened to. I think bubbles and pods were mentioned, but they... Really, it's not the same as a creche because people go off to options. You know, you have people mixing in and mingling.
And you're teaching at second level.
Yeah, and I think the schools are doing their very best. And don't get me wrong, everyone has been meticulous. Everybody has been repeating all of the... And the young people are brilliant at rallying, wearing masks, etc. But we need space. We need extra staff. You know, we need support. I mean, you're teaching through a mask for the whole day to a room of people. No microphones, you know. No laptops to do blended learning. No PPE. Everyone's buying their own. Like, they're actually, mask is €5. You know, it's actually quite expensive. And I think...
Are you not getting PPE from your school, no?
It varies from school to school. But obviously, some are issuing visors, which really aren't the best. But I think that the thing that's probably really annoying most teachers and SNAs is not being considered a close contact when there is a case in a class. A friend of mine yesterday, a mother told her son had COVID. She's a primary teacher. So she's been teaching that student the whole day and was not told. She asked her GP, should she get a test? And the GP said, no, you have to have symptoms. I mean, people who are on the front line, health workers, teachers and others, we should be routinely tested. This is where the whole testing and tracing capacity is really not up to speed. Now, in fairness, the testing can be quite, but then
we've 90,000 tests.
But it needs to be done habitually throughout society. That's what's going to spread
and
it.
Testing is
that's what's going to stop the spread. And there's no other way. That's what other countries are doing that have got this under control. You know, Taiwan, South Korea, New Zealand, etc.
Yeah, Jennifer.
Yeah, I just want to refer back to a point that Patrick made that, you know, that we have to this personal responsibility and we need to make sure we're doing all the right things. And I absolutely agree with that. But there is also a responsibility on government. There's a responsibility to have a very simple message out there that people can understand and adhere to. There is also a big responsibility on a testing and tracing system that is fit for purpose and that is proactive and can actually go out and stay ahead of the waves that we're seeing. And that hasn't happened yet. And there has been months in which the government had time to prepare for this. And it hasn't happened. And until we get that right...
Although, and absolutely, that's a point that has been made in the studio many times over the last number of months. But I heard the chief medical officer saying this evening that we're now at a stage where no amount of resourcing of contact tracing is going to get ahead of this. That when it is, it's letting rip at the stage we're now at.
But I would imagine though there are parts of the country that aren't as bad. Like you reference Wicklow. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we had a proper testing and tracing system in Wicklow, you would imagine that you would be able to prevent any further expansion of the virus there. You know, so there are areas
where you
could still contain it.
Okay, I'm going to take a break here because I want to come back and talk to Malachy Clerkin about whether or not the GAA Championship should go ahead.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, as a Kerry woman, it pains me to even pose this question, but is it time to consider calling off the GAA Championships? Malachy Clerkin, sports writer with the Irish Times. Welcome to Late Debate.
Well, thanks for having me, Katie.
Malachy, before we get chatting, I just want to play you a clip of Darren O'Sullivan, the former Kerry great, speaking to our colleague Barry Lenehan on Drive Time this evening.
We can't go for a bite to eat. We can't do so many things, but we can drive, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours up to Monaghan where they've just been put into level 4. We can go into a dressing room with 30 odd other fellas, play a game of football where there's a lot of uncontrollables in a game of football. With the way the country is at the moment, with so many people having to restrict their movement, restrict seeing their friends and their family, and then allowing players who are amateur at the end of the day, I just think it's very contradictory.
And that was Darren O'Sullivan. We just got a text in here saying pretty much the same thing. On what planet does it make sense that I can't visit my family, but the GAA can send teams the length and breadth of the country? That's Michael. What planet is the GAA on? Malachy.
I guess they would say on the first basis they're on the planet where the government is paying them to hold a national championships. Which is the main reason it's happening in the first place. Like, the GAA has no people paying in through the gates for this championship. It's behind closed doors, so they wouldn't have been able to afford to hold it other than the government are giving them 15 million to hold it. So I think that's an imperative. Beyond that, I think they do have a responsibility to try and hold their championship to see if it's possible. I suspect it will get pretty messy. I suspect that this week, the Fermanagh football panel, the Wexford hurling and football panels have all had positives. Players have had to pull out of the Galway football panel. I suspect that's going to be the way of it over the coming weeks, and it may well turn out that it isn't feasible. Like, they may have to pull the plug halfway through it, but I think they are definitely going to try it.
But that's, being feasible is one thing, but is it advisable is probably the other question. Can we talk about first the last few National League matches clashes that are left on the agenda, and particularly the one this weekend, I suppose, that people have been talking about, is Kerry going to Monaghan, having to travel up to Monaghan for that match. And if it keeps going into the next weekend, Donegal coming back down to Kerry. Given what's happening in Monaghan and Donegal, is that crazy?
Well, I mean, you could say it's crazy, fair enough. The way that Kerry are dealing with it is that the Kerry players are driving, as far as I know, they're all driving in their own cars to Monaghan tomorrow, Friday, and they're booking out a hotel for themselves on Friday night, and they're driving back after the game. You know, the GAA's advice is that teams travel in two buses to allow for social distancing, but Kerry are going a step further. Everybody's driving their own car. Yeah, absolutely. Like, the very fact of mixing between teams in the border counties does sound, on the face of it, it does sound kind of fantastical. But the thing to remember is that, like, all of these players, all of these teams are, they're not tested as much as professional teams are, you know, and even the testing, sure, we saw with the Irish soccer team this week, you know, it's not a hermetically sealed bubble anyway, but they all go to massive lengths in their own lives and when they go to training to try and avoid anything to do with transmission. And what we've seen since the summer across all sports is that actual transmission, on-field transmission during contact sports, is minuscule. That it's tiny compared to so many other things in life.
But Malachy, what we also saw, and we had a discussion at the top of the show with a public health specialist, Una Fallon, that it was those, what happened outside of the sport,
yes,
the partying, the people getting together to watch matches, that was a huge issue during the club championships.
Enormous issue, and you know, it got so out of hand in the end that the GAA cancelled the remainder of their club championships last week or the week before, and it was, you know, it was a really bad outcome, and it sort of coincided with, I guess, a level of complacency in the general public. There, you know, to a certain extent, there's, you know, you can't really blame teams for it, you can't really blame players, but it obviously spilled over, and it was, you know, and it was terrible, and it is, you have to factor that into whether it's right to hold a championship. Like, that is a huge thing. Like, once we get, obviously for the first couple of rounds it won't really matter, but once you get to provincial championships, once you get to the All-Ireland finals, are supposed to be the 13th and 19th of December, it is, of course, it's very hard to imagine that you could have an All-Ireland be decided and there not be some spillover into the public. Like, it's that's a very hard circle for the GAA to square. And I suppose it's up to them to decide whether they're willing to take that risk.
And the players themselves, I know the GPA were asking, surveying the players today, if they feel that they're, you know, being minded, or if they want to play, and if the county management is looking after them. Have we any sense of your sense of players? I presume most of them just want to get back in there, do they?
Yeah, like now, any of them that I have spoken to, and I actually have an interview with Conor McManus from Monaghan in Saturday's Irish Times, where he talks at length about this, that these people think, they really consider themselves outrageously lucky to be able to do the thing that they love at the minute when the rest of the country can't. Like, everything that we all would like to do, we more or less can't, like normal people. But intercounty hurlers and footballers and camogie players and women footballers, they're able to go training three nights a week and play a game on the weekend. And they, they generally, for the most part, are just feeling themselves so lucky to do that and are mad to get play. Absolutely. It has sort of grown a little bit today from John Heslin of Westmeath, his tweet last night saying that he wonders about, you know, how much the players' feelings are being taken into account here. But I suspect the GPA did that survey today, and I think the results will come out tomorrow. I suspect the results will be overwhelmingly
positive,
in favour of players positive and wanting to play.
Okay, will you stay there, Mark? I just want to put it a very political question to, for any politician.
Is it GAA-related or is it a political stuff mind? Go on.
Well, should the championship go ahead?
I think the GAA cancelled the actual club championship. It was actually the right move. Like we saw at my own part of the world, there was too much activity, not on the pitch. I think they managed the pitch platform very well. It was the overspill to the actual communities was the biggest issue. And if we're to move forward in the scenario that we're going to have a Cork Kerry Munster final or whatever, right?
Exactly.
Will you have a spillover in community, and how can you actually, and the GAA...
But sure, even without the big, I mean, we saw the big celebration, like we saw the Black Rock and Cork things, which was astounding to see in the era of COVID. But even without that, where are people going to watch the match? They're going to go to friends' houses, they're going to go to Shebeens, they're going to, you know, it's...
And if you have that interaction, it totally destroys what we're trying to do with a single person going to the house and just kind of lack of activity. Because, like, I understand there's a logic and a mental health issue. We all want to see a hurling match. We all want to see our local provisional team play. We really do, right? But, like, if you're going to have gatherings, it's going to totally destroy the whole ethos of what we're trying to do.
So
I actually think the GAA are in very dodgy grounds here. I think politically we need to start looking at the possibility of having no actual All-Ireland, which is a very unfortunate thing to say. But I do think when you look at what's happening and how things
are
managed...
You think it's too dangerous, really, to put on the championship?
I've actually no problem with the players in the field. I've no problem with even the guys going to Monaghan in separate cars. My problem is how are you going to control the social aspect after?
Ruth?
Yeah, I think... while we all appreciate how important sport is for mental health, absolutely, and physical health... At the same time, when you listen to the sports reports on RTE now, it's like a running COVID report. I mean, it isn't just GAA, it's soccer. Ronaldo has COVID, you know, whole football teams in Britain. And whether it's on the field or off the field, it does seem to be spreading. And these are amateur players, after all, and whether that's an acceptable risk for them. And I think if the cases continue to go up, it's very difficult to see how that can be allowed to continue.
Yeah, God, I think people would be so... Patrick, are you a big GAA fan?
I'm not a big GAA fan, but I think that, you know, if we look at other sports, they have managed to successfully run with this kind of pod bubble system, you know, putting that bubble around all their players.
That's a professional setup, though. I mean, that's a very different setup to what I was about to say.
Yeah. There's a lot more money in those sports. It is a professional setup. So I think what would be paramount here would be two things. First of all, can they control the social overspill, as Tim and Una were talking about? But it's also, what do the players want? Can the players feel they do this safely? Can we guarantee their safety? What risk assessments have been done to ensure their safety is put paramount?
Well, I think we'll find that out tomorrow.
And I think for me, the answer of whether we go ahead or not really depends on that answer, on what do the players want, and can we do it safely?
But surely that can't be part. But what the players want surely cannot decide whether or not it is safe to go forward with a championship, given what we've just been discussing in terms of the social activities that are inevitable almost with this.
If it can be done in a way where the players from one particular county panel are put in a pod or put in a bubble, and that's up to the GAA to provide.
But how can
the
GAA stop the party after your county wins?
But I think, going to come in there. Like, I mean, I think it's impossible to put an inter-county team into a bubble entirely. I mean, these people have families. They have... they have families. They have people that they go home to every night, and I think it's just inevitable that are going to be, the more inter-county games that take place over the next few weeks, the more likely we are to have an outbreak of cases. I mean, we're seeing it in the UK. You know, I'm a big Liverpool fan, and we're seeing with the Premier League that there are more cases arising over the last few weeks than had happened kind of towards the end of last season when the season was resumed. I mean, Liverpool had three cases, and they have two players coming back this weekend, Sadio Mane and Thiago Alcantara, who had COVID-19, have recovered and are back. But it's more and more difficult, I think, to suppress these cases, to suppress clusters breaking out. And I think that's just going to be a major challenge for all elite sports over the winter period. And I think at some stage, both with the GAA and with soccer internationally, and there's been a debate this week about international soccer, about whether or not it should be going ahead, given the number of cases. And Ruth referenced the fact that Cristiano Ronaldo got COVID-19. Yeah. There were a lot of other players who picked up COVID-19 during the international break. That's going to be a debate that I think is going to roll on into the winter, and at some point a decision might have to be made to curtail the amount of elite sport that's taking place. Okay. And that might mean that we have to maybe not have the Champions League, maybe not have the Nations League or the remaining European qualifiers.
I just feel that for a lot of people, though, that the GAA, the county, inter-county championship...
It's huge for people. Yeah, like it's a huge... For people's mental health and for people who have been actually completely beaten down by what's happened over the last 6 or 7 months,
something
it's been
that people
enormously
would,
challenging
would make the
for
winter,
everyone.
It would make the winter pass.
It would make
pass,
the winter
yeah.
completely, yeah. I absolutely agree with that. Like,
So I wouldn't want... I'll just give you a sense, though, of what we're getting in on the text line on it. Katie, it'd be an absolute disgrace if the GAA go ahead with the championship in Monaghan. I'm disgusted that's Noreen and Killarney. Fermanagh are playing Clare and Ennis over the weekend, and if Fermanagh have positive cases, then that match should not take place, says Neil and Clare. And I know that... Fermanagh had wanted to actually forfeit that match because they had a lot of people self-isolating and I think some cases, but as of now, supposed to be going ahead. Katie, all sports events should be cancelled. It's a no-brainer. GAA need to get with the programme. Malachy, I'll just give you the very last word there. There is a sense that this might not happen.
I think it definitely will. I think they definitely will start it. The league matches are going to go ahead this weekend, unless anybody has heard different. I saw Michael McGrath on Primetime there confirming what Leo Bracker said earlier in the day, that if the country goes to level 5, then there will be no matches. Now, that is different to NEFA's advice. NEFA's advice last week was that at level 5, elite matches would still go ahead. So there may be a bit of confusion around that. I would be very surprised if the pin is pulled on this before some rounds go ahead. I think they will try to do it. I think, there is a political push for it, and ultimately the government are paying for it. And so it will happen on some level.
Okay. The Taoiseach did say that he wanted the championship this December. Okay. He wanted an All-Ireland final. So.
Okay, well, I think we all want it. But can we always get what we want is the problem. We only have a minute left, and just before we go, and I'm going to have to take one break before we go, but I just want to ask you, Tim, about that news today about Ryanair pulling out of Cork. It's devastating, obviously, for the whole, and Shannon as well, the Midwest and the Southwest region. Ryanair, very critical about how the government have handled this over the last number of months.
So I would have met Ryanair and I went to manage at Cork Airport 2 weeks ago in Cork Airport. They're down 99% in actual visitor numbers.
Oh, no, we know all that. I'm just saying about the handling by the government.
But I think we're putting the actual traffic light systems coming forward to the capital on Tuesday. That was announced today. But I think even if you had all that in place, the issue of air travel, people want to feel safe. People now will be booking their holidays from next year, from now till next February. There's nobody going to be booking. I think this is going to be a 2 or 3 year turnaround. We need to try and protect the actual infrastructure, protect air, the actual airports itself. And that's where the money has to go, because there's no silver bullet for this, unfortunately.
Okay. Patrick, is your minister going to get this together?
Well, look, the issue is Ryanair have been closing bases here and in other places of Europe and restricting, they're dropping about 40% of their flights across Europe. Eamon has already made money available for Cork and for Shannon in COVID supports, and I think it's important that we do keep trying to support the local economies that depend on these jobs and providing supports for them.
So okay. I'm sorry, Patrick, I'm going to cut across to you because I have to take that ad break before we go to the news.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And I'm afraid that is all we have time for. Just one headline from the Irish Examiner, that story we were just talking about. Airports facing winter collapse as Ryanair closes bases. And that's it for tonight and this week. I want to thank my panel. I want to thank you all for listening. The programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. And Ruth Kennington was on sound. And now it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.